Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. By now, we have heard all the stories about the attempts to marginalize, suppress, and rewrite history. We've heard the stories about laws being passed in various states to prevent the conversation around historic events. One of the more recent situations came up in Texas, where a museum wanted to have a panel and they wanted to talk about the connection between the Alamo and slavery. And there were powerful forces within the Lone Star State that, you know, freaked out. And at the end of the day, they weren't having that conversation. In places like Oklahoma, as we talked about the 100th anniversary, if you can use that word, of the Tulsa race massacre. They like to use the word riots, but it was a massacre that took place. As you had the president and everybody acknowledged that, you also had laws going on the books so that that very topic can't be taught in the schools. And we can go from place to place, Kentucky and other states, Florida, you know, it's one of the more recent ones, where we have these conversations about history. They use the word critical race theory to personify that and then say, let's pass a law so we can't talk about it. I wanted to bring Dr. Sumi Chu, or Chow, is it Cho, right? Yeah, Cho.
Yes,
so, I was like, Chu, Chow, you know, saying, going through all the vowels, but Sumi Chu. She's the director of Truth Be Told Campaign, African-American Policy Forum. Wanted to talk to her about critical race theory, the current political landscape, and how, you know, she and her colleagues are seeing things at this moment, because we are at a crossroads. So I kind of opened it up to hopefully set a tone, and let's jump into the convo.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. Well, you know, many people may be aware that critical race theory is a scholarly legal inquiry that is just trying to ask how and why, after civil rights reforms in the mid-1960s and the adoption of a so-called colorblind norm, that we still have such visible and durable racial and social inequalities throughout society. And so this is the inquiry in question that critical race theorists started with, and the political project that was also adopted to seek to eliminate racial and social disadvantages, especially by critiquing race-neutral, colorblind, objective laws, rules, norms, practices that reproduce these systemic inequalities. Right. So that doesn't sound very threatening, perhaps, raising basic questions.
Right, but that's something that wouldn't even be taught except in a legal school, mostly, right? Upper division. If we're talking about critical race theory and Derrick Bell and that whole inquiry about let's look at policy and how that all works. From my understanding, you tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, it seemed like that was more of a legal framework, right? You kind of had to have your P's and Q's and kind of needed to be up there, you know, to kind of understand it, because I can barely understand it on that level, you know? But it's been conflated and it's come to mean something else. So can we kind of parse through that a little bit now?
Absolutely, and that's an excellent question. And you're correct that critical race theory did originate in law schools and legal scholarship. It was taught in law school classrooms. I taught critical race theory for 25 years in a law school in the Midwest. But then what happened is scholars in other fields and disciplines, you know, including education, sociology, political science, social sciences generally, began to really embrace this inquiry into these durable racial hierarchies and how they remain in the so-called post-civil rights era. Mm-hmm. Then we saw people in other spaces, K through 12 teachers, diversity, equity, and inclusion educators, government agencies, even the military, we know, started to unite around the goal of seeking to educate the public in order to eliminate historic and ongoing systemic racial inequalities. And that's how critical race theory traveled more broadly from its law school origins to really talking about more frankly and candidly systemic racism with the goal of seeking to eliminate structural inequalities.
With the initial inquiries, was there a conclusion that was drawn from that, the initial legal framework that looked and said, here are these policies, let's look at things. Did we come up with an answer, or is it something that we're still looking at and exploring and trying to determine?
I think that is the challenge of critical race theory, is to look at the ways in which contemporary forms of race and racism permeate society, and does so in an institutionalized manner, so you don't need any sort of individual wrongdoers to perpetuate it. Hmm. And so it's at a level of subtlety, you know, that you can see with, let's say, the beginning of government policies around transcribing the reach of the GI Bill, you know, and excluding people racially from its reach, or even from Social Security, right, in terms of excluding farm workers and household workers from its reach, and how these reverberated, how government policies around redlining, stating, you know, who can and cannot get subsidized federal loans, mm-hmm. still ripple through our society today in terms of our highly segregated neighborhoods, which then set up segregated schools and employment opportunities and even access to healthy food and environments. And so these are the problems that critical race theory and fellow travelers looking at systemic forms of racism are trying to unpack. And it has nothing to do with what opponents are saying, which are really focusing on the distortion that somehow it's just a huge guilt trip that's trying to portray individual children as evil or something like that, according to their skin color, which is absurd.
You, Dr. Sumi Cho is our guest this afternoon. You taught for 25 years. So this has been on, this has been around for a minute. You know, 25 years is a long time, and it was there before you started teaching. Were you getting resistance when you were teaching? If so, what was showing up? And is the resistance now, it seems like it's not about facts. It's just about shutting down any conversation of race. That's how I'm perceiving it. But from the academic standpoint and the policy work that you all are doing, where are you seeing the fault lines, you know, and what is that about?
You know, again, I think that's a great question. And if people actually talk to folks who are teaching these courses, if their experiences like mine, it tells you that these courses are very high in demand. And I don't recall a single complaint with regards to students coming out of the class and saying anything like what is being promoted by right-wing news media channels. In fact, I am honored that in, you know, a few years before I retired from law school teaching, that I was given the university's highest teaching award. And I think it's in part because of my specialty courses on race, racism, and US law. Right. So I think that those of us who are professionals, we know how to broach these conversations and have high level conversations and discussions so that we prepare students to have the tools necessary to address society's most intractable problems. Right. So then your question is also about if it's not actually creating a problem in the classroom, and if it's actually, you know, addressing things that all Americans should support, that is to eliminate systemic racism, then why is there such a hullabaloo around it, right? And for that, I think we have to understand that this current backlash against critical race theory is a larger backlash against the racial reckoning that we saw post George Floyd, with the overwhelming support of people from every race, neighborhood, and zip code coming out to say, this is outrageous that this type of brutality, that this type of disregard for American lives on the basis of color can persist, and that we're not going to stand for it. So it's this current casting of critical race theory as simply the latest boogeyman to the alleged threat to the American way of life that is actually just a manufactured moral panic to distract the American public about the paucity of solutions to society's, you know, most troubling problems from the political party that essentially put democracy on life support, as we saw with the Capitol riots.
What I found is somebody who has taught, you know, Black history. The complaint that I got, and it was only maybe one or two, was because, quote, you're teaching violence. And it's like, teaching violence, what do you mean? Well, you know, when you talk about this history, you're always talking about, you know, slave revolts, and you're talking about the Nat Turners and all that. And it was like, well, yeah, you know, you talk about resistance to oppression. And I realized that this person was very uncomfortable about that, you know, and I had to remind him that when we take, quote unquote, Western civ, which is required, we celebrate the resistance against the British, and we celebrate, you know, that's the whole course is around that, you know, and we overlook some of the other things which, you know, were being brought up in the class, like, you know, I didn't, you know, we never talked about George Washington being a slave owner and his brutality. You know, we never talked about Thomas Jefferson, you know, being an enlightened man who actually wrestled with, you know, the morality of slavery and still kept his slaves and raped the woman that, you know, that some people romanticize about, you know, Sally Hemings at 13 years old. And we can go on and on. But, you know, to talk about the resistance, and to see how people were able to come together and survive became very threatening, you know, for, you know, this one person who went to the dean and complained and what have you. And that seems to be a fault line now, because when you talk about systemic stuff, the other issue that I had is that I had people that that came from these far right wing places. They would take these classes to try and learn the rhetoric and to learn the language and to see the framing, and then try to gaslight people with it. And I think, you know, if you're a good teacher, you give them very little room to do that. So I think, you know, maybe it's just me, but it seems like as you take these classes and you start to connect the dots and you show how these things fall into each other and how these systems work, it becomes like, wow, this that really a counter argument. So why don't we just shut it down, you know, and remove it? That's what I've seen. And I don't know if that's the experience with other folks, but it seems like when you start to talk about it from the lens of systems of power, you can't really come back on that. You can't just say, you know, God bless America, we did right. Yeah, but look at all the stuff you did that allowed you to be in this position.
I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, I want to start even prior, because you raise an excellent point with regards to the resistances that communities of color have had to undertake in the face of racial hierarchy, in the face of enslavement, in the face of conquest, in the face of exclusion, right? That self-defense and those resistance measures are then reinterpreted as forms of violence, which in other contexts, let's say contemporary context, is enshrined, let's say in the state of Florida, as stand your ground, right, in terms of these laws. And so it's all, I suppose, in the matter in the eyes of the beholder. But if we go back further to the insights of legal scholar Robert Cover, you know, he wrote very eloquently about the violence of the law itself that setups and structures these patterns, the violence of the law to exclude, the violence of the law to enslave, the violence of the law to say, you know, there used to be a law that would say that Black folks, Asian folks, brown folks, indigenous folks cannot testify in a court of law. Now think of what that sets up. You need a quote unquote credible white witness in order to survive. That's what sets up, in a way, the Tulsa massacre situation, right? Because people can, with impunity, use that type of law to just rain terror upon populations. And that's more classic.
And they did. Right. And that's exactly what happened.
Exactly. So that's the violence of the law that we talk about.
But let's just stop there for a minute. So when you look at the strategies that various communities deployed to survive those conditions, that's a history unto itself. And that becomes threatening. Like, we went through it, but here's how people survived. Sometimes they planned a revolt. Sometimes they play people off against each other. That was the American Revolution, right? You know, we'll fight for the colonists, we'll fight for the British, that type of thing. Or we're going to petition. And I mean, we can go on and on and on. And that's just one group. We're not talking about what indigenous folks did. We're not talking about what, you know, Chinese folks that were here did. We're not talking about other groups that, you know, had to, you know, figure out, you know, how they were going to survive. And I think when you start talking about it from that way, I could probably name off 15 names, from Harriet Tubman to Paul Robeson to Sojourner Truth to Frederick Douglass to Malcolm X to the Black Panthers. We can go on and on. And every last one of them, you know, and I think I did it one time where I gave 15 names, Marcus Garvey, W.E.B. Du Bois. They were either considered communists or terrorists. And at one point in time, you know, both were one and the same, Nelson Mandela. I mean, we go on and on. And so it seems like whenever folks are resisting oppression, they get labeled criminal, they get labeled terrorists, they get labeled a communist, and then we want to, you know, criminalize them. And then when we start talking about history, then it's seen as you're talking about terrorism. Paul Robeson was a terrorist, a commie terrorist. You know, the Panthers were terrorists. You know, we shouldn't even be talking about that. And we need to embrace all these other people who actually raped and pillaged and did so much dirt and hold them up as heroes. It's a mine. It's gaslighting 2.0.
Absolutely. And it's because knowledge is power in a multiracial democracy. That's why it was against the law to teach enslaved people how to read, right? We know this, right? We know that retrenchment, one of the first casualties in a retrenchment is truth, is history, is the ability to speak truth to power. And we know that time and time again, especially with the lost cause narrative from the Civil War. And you raise a very excellent point as well, the ways in which movements for racial justice, for basic human dignity and equality, are distorted into these threats, you know, whether they're terrorist threats or communist threats. So we have this long history of civil rights movements, and Martin Luther King in his day was distorted and disparaged and discarded, did not enjoy the popular reception that he enjoys today.
No, he
was understood to be a commie. He was detested and surveilled by the FBI, right? And let's not also forget that these narratives are also not only red baiting, but deeply anti-Semitic, right? In terms of the suggestion that these are simply New York Jews coming down to foment disturbances within otherwise peaceful communities. And we see the same thing today with the ways in which the anti-Semitic dog whistle is being applied to critical race theory as allegedly being Marxist, hailing from Herbert Marcuse and the Frankfurt School in particular. So we have all of these kind of recurrences and resonances, dog whistles, and gaslighting, as you rightfully point out, that seeks to distort what's really going on and to keep people from having a full understanding of their history and ability to resist, you know, in the face of long odds.
Dr. Sumi Cho, let me ask you this. I named off some of the places where they're trying to pass laws. So we can't really teach basic history. And my first recollection of some of this happening was in Texas, where they were, you know, distorting and trying to rewrite those textbooks and remove the word slavery and take Dolores Huerta out of the books and all this other crazy stuff, and then make it a requirement for you to follow to the letter, you know, the Texas textbooks, you know, which then are distributed to like 40 states around the country, right? Where are things now? And from a policy standpoint, what's the fight back? You know, where do we stand right now? What's the path to resistance that we take to move things in a better direction?
That's an excellent question. And I think we have to understand what's currently going on as part of a broader strategy on the part of the far right and far right extremists that have gone from being a fringe element of society to the very center of the GOP, which should be frightening. And so in many ways, what we are seeing is the propagation of this sort of notion of a great replacement theory, right? That white people and white identity is at risk in large part because of immigrants and people of color. And we saw this with the big lie that the election was stolen. Mm-hmm. Why did that resonate with so many people? Unless they have a conception of democracy that largely excludes people of color from it, right? Because this lost in court after court, based on the lack of evidence of any kind of stolen election, even in front of Trump appointed judges. So that's a false narrative, we know, but people believe it because of this far right vision of democracy that excludes people of color from it. And this is just the latest way that they're trying to, as Steve Bannon, former Trump advisor, stated, is to use critical race theory as the new Tea Party to the 10th power. Mm-hmm. And what he specifically elaborated is that they are going after mainstream suburban moms who aren't even Trump voters that they lost in the last election, right? In order to rile them up into a panic and frenzy, right? So that's what's really at stake here. And we are developing a campaign with a wide range of partners and allies. We are working with African-American Policy Forum, Truth Be Told campaign is partnering with Black Lives Matter at School and Zinn Education Project to call for a series of actions in late August at the back to school time, August 27th to 29th, to stand up and resist these state bans, censoring our true history. We're also calling for a day of action on October 14th in honor of George Floyd's birthday that would be threaded from K through 12 through higher education to say that we resist these efforts to distort our history and understanding of ourselves. But it is an asymmetrical fight. We've got deeply funded with dark money think tanks that have budgets in the hundreds of millions, you know, as opposed to single digits on the other side, funding and fueling this campaign, buying up ad space, you know, for local school board elections as a strategy to win the 2020 and later 2024 elections. So it's a serious fight. We welcome you and everyone listening to join us, aapf.org/truthbetold. We need your support. We need your voices, and we need you to show up at your local school boards to say that you believe in racial justice education and having teachers as professionals work to teach the truth to our students.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned the desire to capture the oftentimes very elusive suburban white housewife. Are these campaigns designed to appeal to them, or are these campaigns designed to appeal to the majority of people that live in our communities, many who probably have not voted, even in high stakes elections? From a campaign standpoint, it's like, well, these suburban housewives are more likely to vote, so let's put our money there. That's been the wisdom, even though I think it's flawed wisdom. versus investing into the community and getting them to go. But we're not talking about just voting. We're talking about people really understanding that part of self-determination would be at least to have the education that you want, especially if you have to go to these schools and what have you. So I'm just wondering, you know, when I hear the names like George Floyd and what have you, that resonates with me. But in those places, it seems like they made George Floyd and, you know, and police reform along with the defund movement, you know, they made it seem something to be frightened about. And so that's what I'm wondering, you know, do we have things that are designed to make maybe those suburban housewives, if they're a target, really see the relevance in this teaching as well? I mean, starting with the suffrage movement on up, I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud, but it seems like, you know, the message that's going to reach me that you have to have probably will be, it probably needs to be very different than these elusive suburban housewives who, as far as I'm concerned, never really liked us in the first place.
Well, you know, you're raising really important points and questions. And I think that the way that I am hearing it is there's one question about strategy that is being deployed within the powers that be in the Democratic Party over the soul of the party and the importance of concentrating, as Stacey Abrams did, on turning out voters of color, young voters, you know, in Georgia that tipped the election in the winning strategy, instead of listening to paid consultants and pollsters who've too often gotten it wrong in the past, you know, instead of concentrating on the middle. So I think that's a legitimate critique that we're seeing, you know, how that's turned out, that we really do need to focus on these communities of color and in Arizona, the Latinx vote that have been the most faithful, you know, to supporting Democratic candidates and racial justice initiatives. But I think the question that is going on within the GOP, you don't have to take it from me with regards to the mainstream suburban mom strategy. This is coming straight from Steve Bannon in a Politico article.
Oh, no, no, I get that. Yeah, right, exactly. I know they're going after with them, but from my observation, they made George Floyd seem like a problem because they attached George Floyd with the defund movement, and they attached the defund movement with the nightly broadcast of high crime rates, and, you know, and conflate that with the Blue Lives Matter thing. And the next thing you know, it's like,
absolutely,
the goodwill we had with people who are horrified about George Floyd last year, now they're like, I don't want to hear about it no more.
I'm so glad that you raised that. And this is what you refer to as gaslighting 201. And that's exactly what this anti-CRT disinformation campaign is aimed at doing. It's to take all of the goodwill that came out of the George Floyd protests and to try to convert that righteous movement for racial justice into something that's unjust. In other words, in short, to convert anti-racism into racism. And that's exactly what they're doing. And this has a long history, if you recall what they did with ACORN, you recall what they did with Shirley Sherrod, if you recall, you know, many other episodes, if you recall the stories of Susan Smith and Charles Stewart, essentially killing their children and families and blaming it on a black man. So this has, if you recall, on the deathbed, Lee Atwater, the GOP strategist who used Willie Horton in order to, you know, play the race card in the Republican elections
of 92,
regretted on his deathbed finally and admitted, you know, that that was wrong. So this has a long history and resonance, which is why people keep returning to this well, but it's exactly that. It is to draw a moral equivalence between movements of for racial justice like George Floyd to essentially the KKK, as Ted Cruz tried to say. And that's why people are now calling for the ridiculous policies of putting body cameras on teachers, you know, as if they're the moral equivalent of cops who kill innocent black people. You know, so that's what we're facing right now, is this distortion gaslighting campaign.
Again, if people want to join the movement to counter this, how do they get a hold of you all?
You can reach out to us at aapf.org/truthbetold or email truthbetold@aapf.org. It's an asymmetrical fight. We welcome your voices, your labor, your donations, and we are putting together a multifaceted campaign.
Last question. Do we have a large contingency of white allies that are going into these suburbs encountering this distortion and really bringing to the forefront the importance of racial justice and having sound history in our schools?
We do, thankfully. So we do have people working, for example, in faith-based communities. We do have, you know, after decades of addressing intersectionality in feminist communities, you know, we have people trying to reach out to these mainstream suburban moms, you know, so that is ongoing, but it's a multifaceted campaign that is going to be doing everything that we possibly can to ensure that these lies don't take hold and to expand the platform for racial justice work.
We appreciate you, Dr. Somi Choi. Thank you for joining us this afternoon from the Truth Campaign. Thank you for joining us. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio.